Ladies and gentlemen, 7 o'clock on a Saturday night, that means it's time for the other podcast. I'm your host, Robert Stacy McCain.
And I'm not. Hi, folks. It's John Hoag here, the other guy on the other podcast, sitting here at the console, staring across the dining room table at Stacy. Stacy, by the way, in case you haven't heard, this is actually a true rumor. Blogs at a blog called theothermccain.com. He's also can be found writing at other interesting places around the internet, like spectator.org.
And you can find my good friend John Hoag's work at hoagwash.com on
That's
a daily
right.
basis.
But you can't find Diana's blogging anyplace. We haven't been able to get her really to be active with her blog. How you doing?
Hi, guys. I love you both. Actually, the last 3 weeks have been bad, but usually I post a little bit about nonprofit world on my own little blog at my business website. I talk about nonprofit world. How interesting that is to most people who aren't in it, I don't know.
Well, we'll talk about somebody's not-for-profit in a little bit later in the podcast.
Yes, yes. We're going to talk all about profit and nonprofit and
yes.
everything else in between.
Why don't we talk about football?
By the way, because it's a Saturday night during football season, I have to update you with the latest NCAA college football scores. Right now in the fourth quarter, number 7, Cincinnati leads University of Central Florida 36-25 with 7 minutes left in the fourth quarter. At time running out, number 19, Northwestern is beating Wisconsin 17-7. And so that's in the, what's that, the Big Ten? Is that still called the Big Ten? I don't know. Used to be called the Big Ten. Anyways, in the Pac-10, number 11, Oregon, is with time running out in the game, Oregon 38, UCLA 35.
Sounds like a football game broke out.
Yeah, less than 4 minutes remaining in Tuscaloosa, where the number one team in the country, the University of Alabama Crimson Tide, is leading Kentucky 56-3. You know, that game started out, it was a little bit of a struggle in the first quarter. Alabama was only leading 7-3, but then they got 21 points in the second quarter, 21 points in the third quarter. They've already scored a touchdown in the fourth quarter, so they're really running it up on old Kentucky.
You know, they could have just done a touchdown every quarter. It would have been like 28-3 or maybe 28-10 if Kentucky got lucky, and it, you know, would have been a sound thrashing.
Kentucky holds a special place in the heart of Alabama fans because Bear Bryant coached at Kentucky. And one year he took them to the SEC title and they gave him a cigarette lighter, right? They gave him a cigarette lighter as a gift. They gave Adolph Rupp, the basketball coach, a Cadillac. Well, okay. And so they decided to get out of Kentucky. So
well, I can understand that.
Final score.
Vanderbilt managed to lose today. So we have managed to keep our record absolutely perfect.
Yes. Number 6, Florida, 38-17 over Vanderbilt in Nashville.
Which was interesting because the Florida coach was complaining about how his team performed.
Well, number three, Ohio State defeated previously undefeated Indiana in Columbus. Iowa State at home, 45-0 over Kansas State. Coastal Carolina, 34. Appalachian State, 23. BYU, 66. North Alabama, 14. And kicking off momentarily, it will be Tennessee at Auburn.
And that's the one game where I can be persuaded to root for Auburn.
Yeah, I have having a hard time rooting for Auburn under any circumstances. But anyways, later at 7:30, Georgia will host Mississippi State. Oklahoma will host Oklahoma State. That's a big local rivalry. Number 21, Liberty University will play at NC State. And then there's some late games out there on the West Coast. But now you're all up to date on what really matters in the world, and that's football.
Well, how about war?
War? Oh, war.
Well, actually,
what is it good for?
Well, it's
absolutely nothing, in the famous words of a song.
Well, yeah, but you know, we haven't had a president for going on 40 years now, who didn't start at least one good war. Until the last 4 years. And President Trump has been involved in cleaning up some of the other messes other people started, he has started exactly 1.0 wars. I mean, 0.0 wars, which is upsetting some of the people who make their living as part of the, I'm not saying the military industrial political complex. ACE. Has Spades has got a piece up called Neocons Educating for More Victory-Free Wars. Again.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, they have if Biden becomes president, they're going to have another shot at it.
Well, they quote, his quote is from Robert Spencer. Robert Spencer, as you know, is from Jihad Watch. And Spencer said, if Donald Trump doesn't take the oath of office on January 20th, one principal but little noted reason for this may be that he crossed one of the most powerful and least accountable forces in the nation, the military industrial complex. Mm-hmm. And,
I understand why President Eisenhower named it that, but it's become a military-industrial political complex now.
Well, I will say this. I was talking about Afghanistan, and I would say the same for Iraq, okay? Considering the situation in that part of the country, I would be okay with us keeping an air base, right, with sufficient defense force to protect that. To keep an air base, just like we've got Ramstein Air Base in Germany, right?
How about just a carrier in the Arabian Sea or the Persian Gulf, and that's within range?
But having land-based aircraft does give us a greater force. And if you look at a map, what lies between Iraq and Afghanistan, right? Okay, so there's that geopolitical strategy argument for keeping at least a pied de terre in each of those countries. Oh, you like that, did you?
I did. But
I threw my French out there just because the ladies love the French, you know. But anyways, a pied de terre is a foot of ground, so to speak. But anyways, I love it when my little allusions like that stick. But anyways, my point is, so there's the geopolitical argument for at least keeping a presence in each of those countries. The other thing is, because my son is in the Army, I understand this, right? Is that the military likes to have a good live fire range overseas, if you know what I'm saying. In other words, that the troops that rotate in and out, you know, just to get a chance to get the deployment points, right? Especially the younger officers and non-coms who missed out on the big war, right? Okay. A chance for them to get something like combat experience.
That's right. Real nice training.
Right.
My problem, and where I'm on board with Ace, is a victory-free war.
Yes.
I fought in one of our victory-free wars in Vietnam.
Yes.
And we could have won the Vietnam War in a matter
of... And as a matter of fact, we did win the war. Okay, we pulled it.
We didn't.
Wait, now hang on a second.
I know what you're going to say, and you're thoroughly, totally, and utterly wrong. Okay?
Okay, go ahead.
We did not win the war. If you want to know what a war zone looks like after somebody's won it, look at a picture of Atlanta in 1864. at a picture of Berlin in 1945 or Hiroshima
in
1945. My point is that the way you win a war is by breaking the enemy's spirit. And we never did that in Vietnam. We never did it in Korea. We haven't done it since 1945.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Wait a minute. The first Gulf War, we crushed that one.
No. Baghdad was perfectly serviceable. We never have destroyed. We destroyed the Iraqi army. We didn't destroy Baghdad's will to resist. That's the reason why it hasn't worked. The closest we've come to
himself. Schwarzenegger himself said that he had been that
not Schwarzkopf. Schwarzkopf.
I'm sorry. My fault.
But the closest we've come to that level of destruction was under Trump with what we've done to ISIS.
Right.
Okay. And that's the closest we've done to it. And everybody's upset and tried to misinform everybody in the military industrial political complex has tried to actually misinform the president about what's going on. You had a good post up about Ben Sasse, who normally is a pretty good guy, but he is just absolutely, he's absolutely in sync with the neocons on this pulling out of Afghanistan. I had a comment. You had a comment to close that post to send him off with a rifle.
Let me just reference what this was about. This is a statement issued by Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska, a Republican. Quote, headlines about bringing the boys home sound good, but that's not what's happening. After this retreat, there will still be American troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. The most important question is whether those remaining troops will be able to prevent Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, Iranian proxies, and others from plotting attacks that can spill American blood, or if they will be exposed as jihadis gain control. Terrorists will exploit vacuums. President Obama's 2011 withdrawal from Iraq opened the door for ISIS. I fear this weak retreat is not grounded in reality and will make the world a more dangerous place, close quote. And, you know, and then I make the argument, of course, that having a forward base of operations over there, you know, I get that argument. But this idea that, you know, we must fight forever after 20 years in Afghanistan. Yeah. But anyways,
We are smarter than the British. And the only thing that the British ever got that was beneficial out of their messing around for
the charge of the Light Brigade was excellent poetry.
Yes, but that was the Crimean War.
Oh, I'm sorry, wrong war.
Yeah, the only thing they got, actually, the only thing they got of any use out of Afghanistan for almost 100 years of involvement was the first line of the first Sherlock Holmes story. Where Holmes says to Watson, "I see you've recently been in Afghanistan," because he has something on his watch fob that's, you know, hanging out of his vest that is related to that. You know, basically you said, you know,
give the ford of Cabell River in the dark. Come on, gotta give Kipling his props.
Yes.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Well, Gunga Din may be a better man than I am. Anyway.
But that's an India sunny climb. That's not
I know. That's true. But the point was, is that you said that you shipped a sass off to Afghanistan with a rifle. And my comment that I put at your blog was just the rifle. He can scrounge for magazines and ammo when he gets there. I just don't have any patience with the idea. If we're going to fight a war, you go fight a war. You kill people and break things until the other people give up, and you don't stop.
And then you go home.
Then you don't go until you're willing to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you know, you can look at history, and history teaches that lesson. And of course, there's the old saw about not knowing history and being doomed to repeat it. But what would you expect? You know, we're about to be led allegedly again by the party of science. Now, I believe in science, but I don't believe in the science that the party of science is peddling. You know, I have a series of posts. There's a page in the menu bar at Hogwash called Science and the Bible, and it's a rough draft of a book I've been working on about the subject of science and the Bible. And I lifted a piece of that in a post called The Party of Science this week, where I talk of basically, here's how the scientific method works. You make some observations. Based on the observations, you form a testable hypothesis, make predictions based on that hypothesis, and then you see if you can falsify one of the predictions. Now, if you can, then you need to go back and come up with a different testable hypothesis. And if you can't, well, instead of making a discovery, you've made a measurement, so you can go back and make some more observations. You know, that's not what is going on with the party of science. And if I could kind of make an analogy, you know, science isn't the only form of knowledge that informs what we do. I talked about history just a second ago. Our morals are something else. And morals should inform our application of the way we test things. And let me give you an example. Suppose I make an observation about the world and notice that there's significant economic disparity in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll offer the hypothesis that the lives of the members of some society might be better, might be improved if they change their polity to have some sort of socialist form of government. And let's say I have the power to make my prediction feasible, and I'll create the Soviet Union. The history of the Soviet Union in the real world suggests that my prediction was false.
Mm-hmm.
But that might be some sort of experimental error. But if I redo the experiment in China and Cambodia, I keep getting similar results. So those observations allow me to form a second hypothesis to test, and that, well, maybe it's not international socialism we need, but national socialism. So I take a look at running that experiment, and Berlin and Auschwitz tend to falsify my hypothesis. You know, fortunately, no one has or had the power to actually run the 20th century as a science experiment. But that 20th century has already happened. And rather than doing science, we can do history here. and see what's likely to work and what's not likely to work. And that's one of the reasons why I'm just not buying what the party of science is selling us. But, you know, there are other aspects of science in our blogging this past week. Actually, this afternoon, this very afternoon.
Yes, I saw what you had written about the party of science. Meanwhile, I was following up on something that a commenter had mentioned at my blog, The Other McCain, and that is namely the news that filmmaker, she been called, actress, celebrity, whatever she is, Lena Dunham.
Stacey, we need to have another talk about Rule 5.
Yes. I've got a post up on the blog right now at the top of the blog, theothermccain.com. It's called The DNA of the Doom, and it was inspired by several things, including the news that Lena Dunham will not be reproducing. A couple of years ago, Ms. Dunham, who had suffered for many years from chronic endometriosis, underwent a hysterectomy, but she still had one ovary left, and a doctor gave her the idea that perhaps they could stimulate, right, you know, do this thing, they could stimulate egg production and do an IVF and have a surrogate mother and all of this stuff. And so she went that route. But then this year, as a matter of fact, on Memorial Day, she says, and I have to put an asterisk beside she says, she discovered that none of her eggs were viable. I quote from her article where she quotes the IVF specialist, quote, "We were unable to fertilize any of the eggs. As you know, we had six. Five did not take. The one that did seems to have chromosomal issues and ultimately." And so that little experiment failed. And she wrote an article about it, first person, because feminists always write in first person. You have to go through a forest of eyes, as our teachers used to say. But anyways, she wrote an article in Harper's Magazine about her experience of finally coming to accept that she will not be spawning. And I took off from that to explain that. How do you get to that point? Because you see, she is one of two children of Carol Dunham. If you don't know who Carol Dunham, and that's Carol spelled like Carroll County, C-A-R-R-O-L-L. Carol Dunham is the scion of an old New England family, being the son of Carol Dunham IV, a leading Connecticut realtor, active in trade associations. I'm quoting from his obituary there of the late Carol Dunham IV. Well, his son became a painter and married Lori Simmons, who is the daughter of a New York dentist, by the way. But anyways, and how rich were the Dunhams? Well, you go up the family tree and you discover that they were cousins of Charles Louis Tiffany, founder of the jewelry dynasty. And when the Dunhams had there was in 2011, the New York Times did a feature story about the Connecticut home of Lena Dunham's parents, and it's a Georgian mansion. But in 2014, the Dunhams sold their loft apartment in Manhattan's trendy Tribeca district, and it sold for $6.5 $5 million. You sell a loft for $6.5 million.
Not
That's
anymore.
A lot. Huh?
Not anymore.
Yeah, well, anyways.
Well, they got lucky anyway.
Now, they got lucky on that, but anyways, they were less lucky in their offspring because, you see, in addition to Lena, the reproductive failure, their other daughter, Grace, is now a non-binary transgender whose pronouns are they, them. So it seems unlikely that Grace will be giving them some grandchildren. And so I went into some of the science of this because, you know, advanced parental age contributes to an increased risk of birth defects, also highly associated with lower fertility. And so I began trying to explain that if you go back into people's family tree, you will find you go back two or three generations and you're liable to find very large numbers of offspring. I'm one of three. My father is one of at least four children in his family who survived to adulthood. He had some siblings who died younger. But anyways, so it gets down to what I've called, what students of evolution call R versus K selection theory. The idea being that the R strategy is to produce more numerous offspring, whereas the K strategy, you have fewer children but greater parental investment. And so this, I go on to explain it, and I set it up as a hypothetical. Okay, suppose that John and Jane have two children. Now, if both of their children have two children of their own, John and Jane will have four grandchildren. Well, if each of those four grandchildren has two children, that means that John and Jane will have eight great-grandchildren. Okay, now we change the hypothetical slightly. What if John and Jane have three children? Well, if each of their children then has three children of their own, John and Jane will have nine grandchildren. If all nine grandchildren each have three children, then John and Jane will have 27 great-grandchildren. So once you get three generations down the line, you see the difference between averaging two children and averaging three children. It's the different. It triples the number of great-grandchildren you have. See, and so the point is that if we would emulate our ancestors, right, you would avoid this problem of the Darwinian dead end where, you know, it trails off into zero descendants, you know? And so, but anyways, and that was my rant about science. It's simple arithmetic.
Well, I mean,
really.
Go ahead.
And I don't disagree with you, by the way, you've said it before and it's true. The future belongs to the fertile. However, I every once in a while think about Laura Ingalls Wilder's family.
Right.
Four girls. One. All four daughters only produced, of the four of them, only one produced a child, and that was Laura. Her daughter, Rose Wilder, I can't remember her married name, did not reproduce, and therefore a fairly promising evolutionary line, Darwinian line there, four daughters. Ends.
Yes, and it's remarkable.
I mean, it happens.
Yeah, it's risk. I mean, this is what I'm talking about when I talk about the fact that, it's almost like I believe it was Napoleon said that luck favors the large brigades or something to that effect. In other words, that while luck matters in war, that numbers will ultimately tell. And it is.
Or as Damon Runyon said, the race is not always to the swift or the battle to the strong, but it's the way to bet.
Yes. And in other words, that the point is that what you're talking about in a larger sense, right? Okay, is that that when you're it depends. Are you talking about single examples or statistics, right? But point is that when you're talking about human populations and their behavior, right, that the individual unit, okay, individual behavior matters.
And you see this among the Jews in the United States. Reformed Jews are having small families. Orthodox Jews are having large families. Hasidic Jews are having very large families. And guess what the Jewish population of New York is beginning to look like?
Yes, and it's the same thing is also true in Israel, right, where the Russians, immigrants who have come in, who withstood the Soviet tyranny, right? And they came to Israel really as refugees, but they brought with them this very traditional sort of view. And why do you think, the Likud party, right? The Likud party is now middle of the road. It's the conservative party, but they're now middle of the road. There's parties forming off to their right.
Yes.
Okay. Of ultra orthodox. And it's the Russians the Russian immigrants who have made that big difference.
Well, that,
there was a
generation of Americans having an influence in Israeli politics. Golda Meir is born in America. Netanyahu's father was a professor in America. He went to high school and university here, and his first job out of his MBA was sharing an office with Mitt Romney at a at a consulting firm. So, I mean, you know, it's like, okay. But so
over the course of time, the point being that if what is it, and I hint at this, by the way, I don't exactly lay it out. How do you get people, as I say in there, you know, I quote Edmund Burke, people will not look forward to their posterity who do not look back to their ancestors. So that how do you get people to young people? How do you train your children, right, to think about this? Well, you teach them about their ancestors. Gosh, do we know of a book that begins with teaching people about their ancestors? Oh, yes, we do, right? Okay, is that the idea of yourself as a descendant of others, right? And this looking back, remember, okay, Joseph was sold into slavery. And because of that, as a weird consequence of this, right, his family then came to Egypt, right? And when his family come to Egypt, they eventually end up enslaved, but they grow numerous, so numerous that the emperor, the Pharaoh decides, oh, we have to wipe out these Jews. We've got to do something, right? And this is what brings Moses and the Exodus, and they go back to the land that was promised to Abraham. Abraham, who had only one son, right? Or, well, he had two sons. But it promises to Abraham, God promises, this is the covenant. I will make of your seed a great nation, right? And so this pride in our ancestry is what inspires us to the future. But
you're ranting, and you're ranting about what we need to teach our kids.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, I went to school too, but you know what I didn't have?
A yellow button.
No, a student loan. But because I didn't have a student loan, I am very, very much the kind of person who believes in yellow buttons. And I hear you have one at your website.
Yes. Okay. Well, anyways, yes. Yes. I thought that was my cue. I'm sorry. Folks, if you will go to my blog, theothermccain.com, you will notice in the top, near the top of the center column, a yellow button with the word donate on it. And if you will click that button, it will take you to my PayPal account, where you can contribute to support the blog and also, of course, to support the podcast. And I would be very grateful for that. And speaking of gratitude, you know, this Thanksgiving, I would like to give thanks to Mr. John Hogue, because over at his blog, Hoguewash.com.
Oh, yes. At Hoguewash.com, we have a icon of a tip jar lurking over there in the sidebar. Click on that, and you're taken off to my PayPal account where you can help support the blog, or you can do your shopping. There's probably some interesting stocking stuffers, and it's almost time to start talking about that.
Oh, man.
So an interesting stocking stuffers might be had from the Hoguewash stores, and that helps support the blog as well. Or, you know, Black Friday and Cyber Monday and all that stuff's coming up, and look for links on bloggers' blogs to Amazon shopping, because those of us who are members of the Amazon Associates Program can earn a commission when you use those qualified links. You'll find some at Hoguewash. You'll find some at the other McCain. But the key to all this is to remember the five most important words in the English language,
which are hit the freaking tip jar.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Anyway,
but you know, I did never have a student loan. I graduated with my Bachelor of Engineering degree from Vanderbilt. We had a football team back then. Actually, we had a really good basketball team back then. But I graduated back in 1970, and I paid my tuition in full every semester. Mm-hmm. Now, fairness dictates that if student loans are going to be forgiven, then those of us who paid in upfront probably should receive rebates with interest.
That sounds good.
And at the current legal interest rate in Tennessee, and I picked that because Vanderbilt's in Nashville, I would be due a bit more than $90,000. So I'm all for that. I'd be willing to take it as a form of a tax credit that I could spread over a few years, but you know, fair is fair. And since I haven't had, why should I have to suffer because to pay for other people's? I should get my cut of the action as well.
I agree.
Don't you think?
I think that's a perfectly reasonable position to take.
Yes, and like I said, they don't even have to come up with the cash. Just let me write down what I owe. That'll work for me. The cash flows works out being the same from my point of view.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. A lot of people have pointed out that this idea of free stuff, you know, this was the agenda of the Obama reelection campaign, free stuff. And you know, of course, nothing is free.
There ain't no such thing as a free lunch.
Right. And the thing is, as you point out, is that, you know, my oldest daughter attended 2 years of community college, working at Pizza Hut, right? Okay. And then she took 2 years at the local extension of Frostburg State University and graduated summa cum laude. She's doing all right and graduated practically debt free. Okay. And she lived at home her first 2 years of college. And so why are some people borrowing tens of thousands of dollars a year, right, to go off to college when in almost every place, community college is so cheap, right? You know, attending community college is so cheap that you can work at a minimum wage job and it's almost nothing.
Well, not only that, but calculus 101 is pretty much the same any place. And I'd be willing to bet that Econ 101 probably is better in a community college.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the point being that if people were, you know, value conscious, right, in terms of, you know, if you start thinking about I'm paying for this, okay, it changes your choices. But so many people, get, you know, and one of the things, and I've got a stack of them over here, I could show you the, you know, my daughter is a senior in high school. My youngest daughter is a senior in high school, and she got pretty good scores. And so she gets a lot of these recruiting brochures and so forth from the small private liberal arts schools like Goucher College, which, by the way, oh, hell no, you're not going to Goucher, because you know whose alma mater that is. Jonah Goldberg. Turncoat. Anyways, but yeah. Yeah, these people that want to go to these pricey little boutique schools. Yeah, that's where the college, and the other people, of course, who take out the maximum amount of student loans they can get, so that they can have vacations and cars and what all.
Okay. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, you know, I can understand why somebody who is going to something like medical school where there's a chance for a reasonable payoff to borrow some money to do that. On the other hand, if they're willing to work for 5 years under actually better conditions during their internship and residency than they would in most other programs, the military will pay them to go get a medical degree. You know, okay. I mean, the books, tuition, the housing, all taken care of, and you get a second lieutenant's pay.
Yeah, and
and you get paid.
Army recruiters have the Army recruiting office is open, folks, and if you can't not good enough for the Army, join the Navy.
Well, but I mean, for example, okay, so you thought you wanted to go to Johns Hopkins, right? Mm-hmm. But you know. I was talking to my cousin who was a surgeon in Tennessee Guard, and Tennessee Guard was sending people to get their medical degrees at East Tennessee State University. Well, you know, that's not Harvard. That's not Vanderbilt. That's not Stanford. But you know what? It's a good medical school, and once you get your degree, and then you serve time in the armed forces, working reasonable hours instead of insane hours. So, you know, but you see, we're talking about how people who have a reasonable expectation of success go about doing stuff.
Right.
On the other hand, if you look at something like the people who are offering these freebies to try to attract voters, all of a sudden, they're not necessarily acting like winners. If you look at the whole thing that went down in Michigan, where they wind up doxing the children of the Republicans in order to force them into certifying stuff.
I mean, yes.
This is like, no. I mean, that just isn't the way it works. The whole thing stinks.
Yes, it does. It reeks. The entire thing reeks. And you know, I have not blogged about the election.
And I've only blogged about it around the edges for this last week. Mm-hmm. But stuff's been happening.
Yes, yeah. Unfortunately.
Well, one of the things that I've been following the saga of a guy probably best known as the Speedway Bomber and as the guy who falsely claimed to be Dan Quayle's dope dealer, who made his way onto NPR in 88 and into Doonesbury in 92.
That would be
Brett Klimperlin. And he has, as part of what he's been doing for the last 15 years or so, been running a thing collecting money for a campaign against electronic voting machines. And his website, protectourelections.org, was up until just before the election.
Yes.
Then it went down, and he had another different election-related site. It went down fairly early before the election. But the protectourelections.org site's back up, but it's hosted on an offshore server. And
wait a minute, an offshore server.
Yes, in the Netherlands.
Yeah. In the Netherlands.
But the thing is that none of the posts that went up after roughly the middle of 2018 are there anymore. Mm-hmm. But one of the posts that I did find that was still up is headlined, U.S. voting machines are susceptible to hacking by foreign actors. Of course, this is a Russia collusion story. But it's interesting, you know, even though that's still up, Kimberlin has just not said a damn thing this election about electronic voting machines. I mean, he's
kind of suspicious.
Yeah, but I mean,
given his Ukrainian ties.
Yes, and
there's a lot of things suspicious going on.
Well, yeah.
Well, yes.
Well, of course, you know, if you over at today at American Thinker, they put a post up about Sidney Powell's talking about Dominion and that whole scam. And you know, it's just like, it's coming out drip, drip, drip.
It kind of needs to be like, under pressure, cuts brooms in half, stream of steam actually, rather than drip, drip, drip. But
it depends on whether they want to win the public or win the election.
You can't win the election without winning the public, at least to some degree.
Well,
now,
you know,
granted, a full third of Democrats think that per Rasmussen, think that the election was stolen from Trump,
and they're right. That's you. That's rare, right, that I agree with a third of Democrats.
Yeah, very rare anymore. But do you know how insane that feels to me? I mean, what that means is that in the end, this cannot be reconciled. How do you have this meant a third of your of the Democrat electorate is saying, nope, this was stolen and we're not. And it's maybe they're saying to themselves, but the orange man is bad. So, but I don't know. I don't think so.
No, I think this is going to be.
That is a disaster.
I think this is going to be devastating to the Democratic Party. But there's several themes that have been going through the drip, drip, drip. Part of this, you know, if you look at what the different ones are saying, for example, what's his face, Lynn in Georgia,
Lynn Wood
is has basically said. Don't to people, and I think Powell has also said, don't certify an election if you want to stay out of jail, because you're signing that under penalty of perjury. You know, it's beginning to look as if, you know, there are enough stories coming out that although they're not proven yet and may not be proven, They call into question in ways that, you know, 20 years ago people would have said, conspiracy theory. But now, having seen what's gone on the last 4 years, people are going, well, yeah, maybe they're doing that. And it looks, for example, the idea that the servers in Germany that apparently the German federal police raided a server farm in Frankfurt and turned the stuff over to the U.S. Department of Defense. And apparently these are the servers that were handling the elections for Dominion.
That's weird.
So
Very. Why would they be using a server farm in Germany?
Because the Spanish company that owns the servers was hiring their rack space in Germany. I mean, lots of people have rack space all over the world.
True.
One of my blogs is hosted in a site in Cincinnati, Ohio. It's where the server farm is, but the backup server's in Vienna.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. International companies, you know, where your servers are doesn't happen anymore. But it's also turning out that maybe some of the backup servers or maybe some of the prime servers for this, some people are alleging, are in China. Well, okay.
That's not a happy thought.
No, it isn't. And if I were the Secretary of State responsible for elections in a state, I would make sure that the server farm was someplace secure in the United States. I mean, you know, there's tonnage of server stuff available from large numbers of people and onshore.
And half of Utah appears to be appears to have warehouses full of servers and racks and racks of them.
The main node of the internet is in Reston, Virginia, and there are something on the order of 100 acres of servers around Reston.
You know, Yeah. 100 acres of servers around Dresden?
No, Reston, Virginia.
Reston, Virginia. Okay. Virginia. I thought you said Dresden. I'm saying, wait, we firebombed them back in the. No, wait, what?
Well, they're newer buildings.
Urban renewal via disaster. Yeah. That's all. Yeah.
I confused Reston, Virginia with Dresden. But
the whole thing is that, you know, everybody is focused on this. And the thing is, Trump and his goal now is to win the election. How he wins the election has to do with the legal strategy that his legal team can come up with and what winds up happening in the Supreme Court. Trump doesn't have to get more than 200. Trump doesn't have to get 270 or more electoral votes to win. What he has to do is deny that to Biden. Now you're saying, well, look, if Biden has fewer than 270, then Trump has 270 or more. And the answer is no. Suppose the Supreme Court says, well, you guys just blew it. You got no electoral votes. Okay, and you could wind up, as long as no candidate has 270, the election goes to the House of Representatives.
Aha. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And the Democrats believed their own propaganda too much.
Uh-huh.
They thought they were not going to lose seats. They thought they were going to flip seats. They thought they were going to flip. They didn't. As of right now, the Republicans have flipped either 12 or 13 seats.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, we have almost exactly the same count that I'm about to talk about. We talk about control of the House of Representatives. We usually talk about the majority of the whole House, because that's who elects the Speaker, and the Speaker runs the House. And the Democrats have the majority, and they are going to have the majority of House members.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another way to talk about the majority of the House, and that's the majority of control of the state's delegations. That's been important twice. In 1800 and in 1824, no one got the required majority in the Electoral College, and so the vote went to the House, and each state's delegation gets a vote. Right now, there are 26 states controlled by Republicans, 22 controlled by Democrats, 3 equally divided, and depending on how things go in Iowa, it will either be equally divided or flip Republican. Mm-hmm. So the Republicans got 26 or 27 votes out of 50. So if the election goes to
Wait, does the vice president get a vote?
No, the vice president isn't a member of the House.
Ah.
And the vice president doesn't get a vote in the Senate to elect the vice president either.
Right.
And that's just voting by the senators. And so if, depending on how things go in the Georgia election, we could have President Trump and Vice President Harris.
Shut up.
That would be
I knew you were going to some weird place.
Well, would be actively funny, and I probably would enjoy that a lot more.
I might almost buy a ticket.
Yeah, that's the theme from The Odd Couple.
Yes.
Anyway, that's why control of the House is important, and that's maybe the ultimate reason why the Democrats blew the election. Part of the problem has to do with the fact that while there were Biden voters, there may not have really been enough of them.
Well, I think the problem is we've got too many Biden voters in this country, including one who was arrested this week in Washington, D.C. During a pro-Trump rally last Saturday in Washington, D.C. It was a gigantic success, as you know. Huge crowd came out to show their support for President Trump. What?
And they did not litter. They picked up after themselves. It was beautiful.
Right.
They picked up after the BLM crowd, too. Right.
Well, after the rally, we found out who Black Lives Matter really represents. A man caught on video, and here I am quoting from the Washington Examiner. A man caught on video sucker punching a Trump supporter in Washington, D.C. this weekend is also a registered child sex offender. 39-year-old Kenneth Wayne DeBerry of Southwest, D.C. was arrested for disorderly conduct, inciting violence, aggravated assault, and felon in possession of a firearm after, according to D.C. Metro Police, who made arrests following violence against Trump supporters after the Million MAGA March, as they called it.
Federal possession of a firearm by a felon while committing a felony is 5 years minimum.
Yeah. DeBerry is a registered sex offender who was convicted in 2008 of second degree child sexual abuse against a person under 16 years of age. Quote, it's quoting a police statement about the arrests in D.C. Quote, the suspects were involved in a collaborate effort to incite violence during First Amendment assemblies at the listed location. One of the suspects struck the victim, rendering him unconscious. Other suspects assaulted the victim and took his property. Four suspects were apprehended at the scene by responding officers, close quote. And so the same media that spent all summer telling us that the riots were, quote, mostly peaceful protests have been lying about the Black Lives Matter movement ever since it began. It is not a movement against systemic racism. It is a movement against law enforcement, period. And
it's a systemically racist movement itself. But, you know, this guy came out a lot better than some other Biden voters. And I'm absolutely sure that JoJo Rosenbaum actually voted for Biden.
Yeah, that would be interesting to know. Yes, if the ghost of JoJo Rosenbaum was among the Wisconsin voters, because, you know, Wisconsin was a swing state. I had an item just yesterday, as a matter of fact, on the blog about JoJo Rosenbaum and the problem of white trash America. Now, I had done a post that has gotten just huge numbers of hits in the past 3 months, where I wrote about Joseph JoJo Rosenbaum, who was the guy who attacked Kyle Rittenhouse in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Now, if you know what happened, if you, and there have been documentary videos about this, what happened was that Kyle was basically minding his own business when JoJo Rosenbaum, apparently in mistaken identity, mistook him for some other guy that had been with those rifle carrying guys protecting private property there. But anyways, JoJo Rosenbaum charged Kyle Rittenhouse trying to take away his rifle and got shot dead. Mm-hmm. Now, hello, if someone is legally carrying a rifle, right, and you are trying to take away their rifle, what do they think is going to happen? Right after you take away their rifle.
Well, let's pretend I'm illegally carrying the rifle and you try to take it away from me. What do I think might happen?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah, the point.
Well, by the way, if my finger's on the trigger and you pull the rifle away from me, guess what might happen?
Yeah, that's a little accident there. But anyways, JoJo Rosenbaum got shot dead. Well, I wrote about that at the time, 3 days after that riot. I wrote documenting JoJo Rosenbaum's record as a convicted child molester. JoJo Rosenbaum sexually molested 5 boys, their ages were 9 to 12.
And he was attacking an underage male.
At the time of, yes, as many commenters have pointed out. But anyways, but the point being that I 3 months ago I wrote about this, but then I turned my attention to the election campaign and didn't look back. And in the meantime, the Washington Post published a very detailed report on JoJo Rosenbaum, which also included important background on the other dead rioter, Anthony Huber, and the details of the events. And what it boils down to is that JoJo Rosenbaum, and having spent over a decade in prison for it came out of a very hard background. His father apparently abandoned his mother, like from the day. JoJo Rosenbaum only met his father twice in his entire life, claimed that he was molested by his alcoholic stepfather on an almost daily basis. He spent 10 years in prison, over 10 years in prison. He had a history of drug abuse and mental illness the day that he got shot to death. That very day, he had just been released from a psychiatric hospital after his second suicide attempt in as many months. And so this guy, as I said, it's white trash America boiled down to one person, because the breakdown of the family in America is producing children, right, who grow up, you know, that grow up to be adults that have never had the sort of stable, safe and secure kind of upbringing that means so much to
And them. If you look at the 20th century experiment on how to handle this sort of problem in our society, we see that we had a war on poverty, and poverty has won. And that not only means economic poverty. It means moral poverty as well. But they're going to protect us from hate crimes.
Oh, yes, they are.
Well, you know, the FBI put out some statistics this last week or so. And guess who is the number one, guess which group, ethnic group is the number one victim of hate crimes?
Jews, always Jews.
You're
the
right.
The hatred and the one that that people try to ignore.
And it's like they're 2% of the population and 60% mm-hmm. of the hate crimes. So like they get like 30 times their share.
Right.
Now, where do you think these hate crimes occur? Do you think
urban
it's
areas.
Where do you think that?
It's where the Trump voters live, I guess.
Well, actually, I would guess that most people who are suffer a hate crime suffer it where they live and work. So where do we have Jews in the United States? Well, half of them live in four states. There are just under 1.2 million in California and just slightly fewer in New York. And there's about 650,000 in Florida and about 550,000 in New Jersey. So that's a little more than half the Jewish population.
In four states.
And the only one of those states that is kind of red is Florida. And guess where the Jews live in Florida?
Yeah. Well, they don't live in Polk County.
Live in Broward County and in
Palm Beach.
Dade County.
Yeah. The thing is, there is this idea, and I've written about this idea that Republicans are the problem in America.
Well, we are because we won't get out of the way.
Right. Is that, in other words, what they keep coming back to is this idea that everything that's wrong in America is somehow blamed on Republicans. And so, hate crimes. We've got to do something about hate crimes against transgender. Well, transgender women of color are being killed in this country. And then you start looking at the suspects who are killing transgender women of color, and it ain't Republicans, folks. I just want to point this out. They don't look like MAGA voters to me.
No. But then again, well, look, it's you and I are the problem. And our plaintiff of choice, Brett Kimberlin,
he's a progressive.
But one of the things he actually accused us of was being Republicans. Do you know what he also accused me, and I'm pretty sure you of also? Being members of the Sovereign Citizen Movement.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Fat chance.
Yeah, well, this week, and by the way, I have almost consciously tried to avoid talking about the election because it's very depressing to me and I wanted to be something cheerful. And so I wrote about the Sovereign Citizen Movement. Now, folks, if you don't know who these kooks are, by the way, this is one of the issues where me and the Southern Poverty Law Center agree. And also a majority of America's law enforcement community agree that the Sovereign Citizen Movement is the most dangerous terrorist movement in America.
Okay? And they're crazy.
They are crazy.
And Stacey, crazy people are dangerous.
Crazy people are dangerous. And so I, one of the things that I have been doing to kind of hide my head away from cable TV so that I don't become depressed over the news is that I sit around watching police videos, right? Car chases, right? California, the helicopter following the car chase pursuit around LA. But anyways,
have they caught the white Bronco yet?
Yeah. Well, anyways, but I'm watching this, these videos, and I started watching these videos of the sovereign citizens and what happens when they get pulled over by the cop, because they have, there's this video, it's on my blog, it's on the front page right now, called Sovereign Citizen Bingo, of the things that these people say. And you know what's going to happen when it starts out, because it's going to end up with a woman screaming, the window being broken out, because it is so classic. With the sovereign citizen gets pulled over, and and the cop comes up to the driver's side window, and the driver opens the window about an inch, right? And the little excuses and the little slogans that they make, and it very seriously, we're laughing at it, but it really is a menace to public safety, because it ties up law enforcement resources. And if you're wondering why cops might be a little trigger happy sometimes with the suspect resisting arrest, watch these videos, man. I don't know. I would be, if I were a cop, I would be permanently on administrative leave, because as soon as I got back on the street and I ran into one of these kooks, I'd have to shoot him, you know. But I put up some videos, and you have got to watch this. The problem that's what really underlying this sovereign citizen thing is the idea of equality. Now, you and I, John, are certainly old enough, and I know Diana probably is too, old enough to remember where we were taught about authority, right?
My father did a marvelous job.
Yes, yes, yes. If you defied authority, you're going to get it, okay? And there was no Department of Children's Services was going to rescue you when he wore you out with that belt. And your teachers, teachers would also wear you out.
Actually, it was Mary, our maid, who would use a switch.
Switch. Ow. Oh, if you, one time in my life, I was visiting my grandmother McCain down on the farm in Alabama for a few weeks. And I don't know, I don't even remember what I did, but I was wearing shorts. And she sent me out to cut a hickory switch. And boy, you put a hickory switch on a bare leg.
An elm switch will do.
Yeah.
That was the elm tree right out the back door.
The point is, it's in the Bible. Spare the rod, spoil the child. It is that the child must learn authority. And one of the things that is that one of the advantages, right, between you and a child, right? Because children aren't stupid.
Mass ratios to start with.
Right, mass ratios, says the engineer, but you're bigger and you're stronger, okay? I told you to clean up the room. The room is not clean. My strength and size are now going to be applied to the problem, okay? You don't have to do it too often, right, for them to remember the lesson, unless they're thick-headed kids like me, and I used to get beaten quite a lot. But anyways, I deserved it, too. I've always been a bad boy. But speaking of bad boys, I hear that boogie-woogie piano in the background, and that means we are nearing the end of the show. Are we going to be back on Saturday?
Are we? I'm going to be around.
All right, then. You're going to have to enjoy your Thanksgiving dinner. Give thanks to God, from whom all blessings flow. And we will be back here with a little bit bigger bellies Saturday, 7 p.m. The other podcast, children, don't miss it.
Yes, and I'm going to enjoy venison this Thanksgiving.
All right. See you, Diana.
See you. Good night.
Good night, everybody. Oh,
Armstrong.